Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining me yet again. We now have 44 clips on YouTube, which is fantastic. So please do share them around that people need some lifelong learning or philomath like I am. So welcome. Today, I've got a great friend of mine, somebody I met 20 years ago when I gave up my real job, or perhaps I'm doing my real job now and I didn't have a real job in financial services. Andy Gilbert. I met Andy Gilbert when I was doing my research and my study into personal development, what high achievers do, how people can be successful, etc. And he was a participant on a program run by Peter Thompson, who you've all met and know. But Peter, and he won't mind me saying this, has a short attention span, and he sets things up and then he gets a bit bored with them and he moves on. And he was going to move on, but Andy said, hang on a minute, Peter, why don't I help you out? And we have a joint venture called the Consultants Development Network. And I was a member of that for a couple of years, learned loads and loads of information and lessons. It was absolutely brilliant. At that time, Andy had brought out a book. He said, I shouldn't show you that because he had a strange shirt on and he looked about 13. And there he's got a red tie on, etc. So he asked me not to show that, so I better not show it or he might log off. The other thing I wanted to tell you about Andy is a Leicester City supporter, and I'm an Arsenal supporter, and he invited me to watch Leicester City play Arsenal. And I hadn't realised that the King Power, there's 30,000 crazy Leicester supporters and about 1,000 Arsenal supporters, and we were in the Leicester City end. Anyway, Leicester City got beaten 5-3 by Arsenal that day, and Andy said, whatever you do, if Arsenal score, you mustn't stand up, you'll get killed. Anyway, unfortunately, after the fifth goal, I leapt up and Andy's pulling me back into the seat. And people are whispering in Andy's ear, is that bloke with you an Arsenal supporter? Anyway, that was quite a life-threatening issue. Anyway, a bit of fun. Great guy, Andy. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Andy. Andy's always been ahead of the game. He's always been an entrepreneur. He's always made things happen. And he's written 20 books and done all sorts of things. His books and his systems called Go Mad. I never quite got my brain around that. It has double connotations, but of course it actually stands for go and make a difference. And that's what I'm crazy about as well, the difference that makes the difference. Go out and make a difference to people. I've got Andy's CV. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about it. Andy's got a free app, if you want it, called Thinking Good. He's written over 20 books, over 200 audio and video programs, gathered a wealth of knowledge and experience as a top business coach. I can certainly tell you that because Andy gave me an hour of his time. I drove up to Leicester, he gave me an hour of his time and gave me his secrets when I was starting out as a consultant myself. And I offer that to everybody else on the basis that what Andy did for me. Come and join me. 8 o'clock in the morning, drive to Guildford, and I'll give you half an hour of my time. Most people, and I bet Andy finds this, don't take you up on that, even though, you know, you're going to give them free consultancy, all your wisdom, etc. And that offer's open to anybody watching this on YouTube, etc. Andy is chairman of Think Leicestershire. Didn't know about this. Currently training 1,000 volunteer community coaches as part of an ambitious community engagement program. Well done, Andy. That's fantastic. The more we can give out, we'll make the world a better place. So thanks for joining us, Andy. Tell us a little bit about you and tell us a little bit about Go Mad.
Right. Well, what can I tell you about me? I am a passionate person about helping people make a difference. You could be 7 years old, you could be 77 years old. Everybody wants to make some sort of difference in their life. And I very often describe my work very simply as just helping people get from A to B easier. So if A is where you are now and B is where you want to go, it could be a physical place, it could be a goal or an achievement. The way that you think affects your abilities, and those abilities affect your results. So I use the simple little thing of thinking, action, and results. And then I'm a pragmatist. You know, I've got a background in cognitive psychology, and I like to make very complex things easy. So I tend to pitch all my books at a bright 12-year-old level. So bright 12-year-olds can apply them. And then I think they tend to be quite easy to digest, easy to read. I run training programs around the world. Well, I used to before lockdown. But what's interesting, actually, my latest client is from Australia. So I've got an insurance client out there that says, actually, I've been using your stuff in the newsletter. Please, can you kind of produce some videos for us and some content? So that's it. So now I'm into video production, video content, webinars, podcasts. I had a very successful podcast series of about 260 plus episodes called Thinking for Business Success. And we started that about 10 years ago, and that went to number one in the podcast charts for iTunes in the business section ahead of the Harvard Business School. So I think simple stuff does work sometimes.
Brilliant, brilliant. So I think we need to know something about that, the process. So you've simplified the psychology, cognitive behavioral psychology, and that you've simplified it so people can set goals and they can make it happen and they can change their life. How does that work?
So if we rewind back to 1998, we did some research, and that research lasted for 14 months. Myself and a group of seven other people, I was leading it. There was one person full-time, there were seven part-timers, including myself. And we set out to answer a question. And the question was this: I've just done a master's degree, and they wanted me to do a PhD, but I was setting a business up at the same time. So I thought, I'll do the research, but I won't publish it academically. I'll publish it into what became a best-selling book. So the question was, what is the simplest way of explaining the success process that people naturally use when making a difference? That's the MAD bit. So key things there, success process that people naturally use. And there was a mistake in that question. And I didn't know enough about question design as I now know, but there was no literal process where you go from A to B to C to D. What we uncovered through this research, and it was what was called a phenomenological study. Now that's the longest word I'm gonna use today, Derek.
Good.
A phenomenological study basically means you study the phenomena of something. So we went and I found three people to interview. One was a 69-year-old person that had just completed a PhD. One was a person that had a very successful business in the city. And the other was somebody that had used to have a very stressful job, but managed to achieve what a lot of people said was the perfect work-life balance. And at the end of this interview, which was all about making a difference, we asked them for three referrals, okay? Two or three people that they could nominate that we could then go and interview. And that's how the research went. And so throughout the whole of 1998, 99, right, we were interviewing people and they were referrals. So apart from those first three, we didn't nominate, I didn't pick any.
Okay.
We also went out into industry, 11 clients that we had, and we asked them to nominate role models that had made a difference. And we filmed them, we audio recorded them, we took loads of notes. And essentially what came out of this research were seven key principles that everybody was unconsciously, sometimes consciously, but naturally applying to go from A to B and achieve whatever difference they wanted to make. So those became known as the seven key principles. And we then formed those into a framework. And we developed something that at one level is very simple, seven things, and at another level is very sophisticated because it's actually a system. So it's actually now become a systems thinking approach that can be used within an organization to embed a methodology of cultural development and continuous improvement. And basically, it's all based around a shared toolkit of seven key things.
Okay, that sounds a bit jargonistic, if you don't mind me saying so. Can you simplify that for a guy with only three GCSEs?
Okay, so let's say you want to go from A to B, okay? I would say the first two key principles are about having a strong reason why. So this is all to do about motivation.
Yep.
If you want to go from A to B, you've got to be motivated and have a reason to go there. It can be a towards motivation or it can be an away from motivation. That's the first key principle. Second key principle is you need absolute clarity of where B is, right? So what is your clearly defined goal? Having a clearly defined goal, okay. A third principle is about having self-belief. It's all very good having the passion, the enthusiasm, the energy, your driving force, But actually, you actually need to believe that it's possible. So if B was going to the moon tomorrow, you probably wouldn't have a very high level of self-belief it could do it. But if B was going to a place 50 miles away, your self-belief would be higher. So what that's reminding us to do is to check, have I got what it takes? So that's your internal stuff that gives you that inner confidence. But it's also about checking the achievability of your goal. So we call these three things a triangle. If you imagine that at the pinnacle of that triangle, you've got your head stuff, which is your self-belief. You've got your heart stuff, which is your reason why. And then you've got your goal, which you haven't yet communicated with each other. And when I'm doing stage presentations and conferences, I very often use a little joke about music going back 24 years or so. So if you imagine the year, Derek, is 1996, okay, and the Spice Girls have just burst onto the scene, knowing that you are a massive Spice Girls fan.
Massive, Andy, massive.
What was the name of their first big hit single, or how did it go?
Don't know.
Yeah, no, you do.
Do
but,
I?
But you're telling yourself, yeah, because you've heard it so many times. Right, I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. Have you heard that?
I have heard that, yeah.
Okay, I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. The Spice Girls have got the first two of those key principles. I'll tell you what I want is a clearly defined goal. What I really, really want is a strong reason why. They then spoilt it by going zig-a-zig-a, okay? What they should have done is go, I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want, then I'll check my self-belief and the achievability of the goal. It doesn't scan very well, and you can only get it on a very rare Eastern European import label, but that's the gist of it. So if you remember a bit of girl power, I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want, and then I'll check my belief. So there are three principles. The fourth principle was about possibility thinking and building a plan of priorities. So I call these the three P's. You know what you want, why you want it, you believe you can get it. So there's a range of questions that you can ask yourself that's all about opening your mind, exploring obstacles, issues, people to involve, tasks, resources, etc. You build those into a plan of priorities. That's the key principle. Fifth key principle is about involving others. And this might seem very simple, but so many times when I have hundreds, probably thousands of times now, when I ask people as a group or a training program, think of the concept of involving others. Who do you think they think of, the first three people that come into their head? Friends, family, colleagues. Not necessarily in that order. People we live with, people we work with, people we socialize with. That's the way that the mind works. It will go to the easiest things first.
Okay.
Yep. But actually, if we take that principle of involving others and say, who in the whole wide world could you possibly involve? You go, dear Google, 6 degrees of separation, all of that.
Yep.
But then let's stretch it beyond that. And that would give you access to a couple of billion people, perhaps that are just using the internet. Then you go, who in history has left a legacy? So I know, I can see behind you, Derek, your library of books there, you know, like me, an avid reader. This is a body of knowledge. Most of the people perhaps on that bookshelf are no longer alive, right? But they've left a body of knowledge. That's still involving them. They've left a legacy. So I involve some of my heroes like Walt Disney for creativity, for Einstein, for the way that he would phrase questions, right? And you go back in time. But then you could even go, what about people that that have never existed? Fictional people. We might get inspiration from a film or a piece of fiction. Like, kids are much better at doing this than adults because they're not quite sure whether they're real or not. But you might take inspiration from Superman or a fictional person from Sherlock Holmes or something like that. And so this is all within that concept of involving others. So the key principle is, who could I possibly involve? And how can I communicate and get buy-in from them? Just a couple of key questions to ask yourself. So there are five. The sixth key principle that lies at the heart of the model is about taking personal responsibility. So personal responsibility, the opposite of that is when you're blaming someone. Blaming the government, blaming the weather, blaming COVID, whatever. It's got no place in my life to blame, right? Take responsibility, and that gives you choices. So this is about, from a psychological perspective, understanding that the locus of your control is within you, not external there. Okay. And when you say I am responsible for something, right, what can I do to make a difference? That's empowering. They're the first six key principles. That's all about thinking. Put those together and say, well, thinking's not good enough. We now need to take action. So the seventh key principle of making a difference, if you want to get from A to B, is to take action and measure the results. Right? Are you on track and moving towards B? If not, take personal responsibility, involve others, ask for help, okay? Consult the plan, rejig the plan, take action and measure results. So you see there, it's not a linear process. This is a system or a framework that can be used in a multiple of ways.
Okay, Andy, that's very interesting. Do you want me to show that on a slide? Is that slide seven? So let me check my computer skills. And that's the slide, isn't it?
That's the slide.
That defines that. So that's define the goal, personal responsibility, and take action and results. There was two things I wanted to mention there. We've talked about the imposter syndrome quite often. We've talked about people not being self-confident. In fact, Rachel on here runs seminars on that. So two of the things were, one, self-belief, because a lot of people haven't got self-belief, but they might have those ideas. And the sixth one you mentioned, which I've written it down here, I can't remember, is...
Personal responsibility.
No, absolutely. How do you get around that? Because it's okay talking to a team, isn't it? But, you know, there'll be people in there that aren't buying into it, but they're going to be keeping quiet. Any thoughts on that?
So, yeah, very simply, sometimes when I'm working with a group or one-to-one, if people are not positive and perhaps they're moaning or they're blaming something, I might just use a two-step questioning process to check. Number one, their reason why. So I might ask a deliberate close question like, can I just check, Derek, are you bothered by this? And you're either going to go yes or no.
Right.
And if you go no, I'll go, well, stop moaning then, because I'm not enjoying this conversation, right? That kills that one down.
That's pretty blunt, Andy.
I can be Joe Blunt at times. I might not say it like that, but I would to you, mate. Right? So let's suppose you're moaning away and I say, Derek, are you bothered about this? And you go, yes, I am. My next question is this. So what difference do you want to take responsibility for making in connection with this? Right? That's it. Simple. I'm giving you a choice, because personal responsibility is about choice. Right? So sometimes when I'm working with clients in the corporate world, we might be doing something. Half the people want to be there. Half the people are just there doing a job.
Yep.
If I say to them, I tell you what, let's make a list of all the things that irritate you about working in this organization. Let's make a list of the things that you're bothered about in your role, or the way that this team works, or the way this process works. And we list them all out and we have fun doing that. I might then divide them into two and say, which of those things are what we call a given? In other words, a given is something that you can't do anything about. The weather is a given, right? Being stuck in a traffic jam is a given. Perhaps a set of policies within an organization, say, like, I know your background's financial banking. You know, there's a lot of regulatory things there that you might not like them, but they are a given, right? So there's no point moaning about them. So we separate all the givens out, and that leaves us with a list of things that if we choose to, we could make a difference about. So at an individual level or at a team level, we say, well, let's pick one or two of those then. And let's start to work it through a framework of questions to see what difference you want to make. So let's start with the why and the what. Why are you bothered about this, and how strong is that in comparison to other things? Right, now let's have a look at getting absolute clarity about what good looks like, or about what great looks like, or about what excellence looks like. And let's use one of four goal defining techniques, pick the appropriate one, right, to get absolute laser-like clarity. Right, now I'm going to ask you, is that what you want to achieve, what you really, really want, in the words of the Spice Girls? And if you say yes, I'm now going to say, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, Derek, self-belief, bringing that in, what's your current level of self-belief that is achievable? And you'll give me a number. And that number, well, if you imagine here that my pencil is a seesaw like this, okay? And at this end where the rubber is, that's belief. So you could have high belief and low doubt, but you could have high self-doubt and low belief. And just asking you that for a number, and it's not just the number that I'm looking at here, it's the speed of response, it's your tone of voice, it's the body language that goes with it. So if I say, Derek, on a scale of 1 to 10, how confident are you that Arsenal will qualify for the Champions League? Right? I can see one. The body language, right?
Like, one.
Yeah, you might just go one, right? But if some people, they'll go 5, and that vocal tone indicates, yeah. I'm wobbling, right? Some people might go 10. Now, they're fan, but they're fanatic. They're delusional, because it ain't going to happen, right? So just doing that little self-belief check, that is a really practical thing that you can teach kids, you can teach friends, family, you can teach your team. Let's check our goals using a scale of 1 to 10, a seesaw effect. If I've got helpful stuff going on in my head, I've got high confidence, I'm going to give it a high number, right? Or it could be a low number. But this is what COVID is doing for people, Derek, is it's affected all their goals this year. You know, I'm talking, every week I coach about 5 or 6 chief execs, right? And without exception, they've all said to me, my 5-year plan, my 3-year plan, it's no more, it's scuppered, right? Because something happens and the self-belief can drop just with a piece of information, right? So let's build shorter plans. Let's have shorter goals, right? And that does 2 things psychologically for you. One is, when you define a goal for yourself, right, that you believe is achievable, right, and you're looking forward to, the dopamine kicks in, the happy juice. It yep. makes you feel good with the anticipation of a goal. Now, when you achieve a goal, the dopamine also flows. So logic tells you it makes sense to have lots of short-term goals. And that's why in organizational change, which is most of where my work is, right, you hear the expression, let's get some quick wins. Now, the quick wins do 2 things. It makes people feel happy and it builds their self-belief because they've now got a memory that they can look back on and say, well, we achieved that yesterday or we achieved that last week. Let's build a platform of small wins. So that was a lengthy answer to your question.
Just that was about a great answer. That's a great answer.
I could talk for at least an hour or two on each of those two each key principle. So,
where no, I can see that, Andy, and your passion comes through on Zoom, which is fantastic. So thanks for doing that. Couple of questions. I love, for everybody, I love that on a scale of 0 to 10 or whatever it is, where are you? Now, psychologically, generally, people say 7 or 8, Andy, don't they, in that sort of situation when they're put on the spot?
Well, there's two different contexts here. If you ask somebody generally, how are you doing? How are you feeling? They might go okay or not bad. They might rank them. But I'm using this in the context of having a specific, clearly defined goal.
Okay.
So if you say, right, Andy, next year I want to go to a place in Brazil maybe, or the Bahamas or wherever it is, and you clearly define B, you've got the date of your holiday, you've got your location, and I say, Derek, on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your level of self-belief that you'll be there?
Okay, so that's a 10 on the basis right. of describing okay. that.
Yeah, now, but some people might go, well, actually, Brazil are really badly hit by COVID, so I might want to change it because you get that piece of information, it can affect your self-belief.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Now, I also wanted to talk to you about short-term goals because I'm a great believer in it. Maybe you taught me some of this, I don't know, but...
I'm sure I did.
You're not getting the credit for it. I stole it, and that's one of those things that you'll have to live with. But some of you saw I sit by my potato patch in the morning at 7 o'clock and I go through my list, and sometimes I put it on LinkedIn. I like setting short-term goals for a week, for a day, or even for an hour because yeah. that makes me go for it. No coffee until 10 o'clock, or I put a LinkedIn post up, or I've got the speakers for next week or whatever it is. That makes me feel good, but most people don't get that, do they? That works for me.
That's the whole thing, because it's, you know, you're setting yourself anticipating goals and you feel good when you achieve it. That's the dopamine cycle going. and then you reward yourself for it. So it's the biggest, it's one of the biggest tips I could give people, that if they're stuck with something or they're feeling really overwhelmed, and there's a lot of people feeling like that with the whole COVID situation, don't know where to start, my business is collapsing, whatever, is say, right, don't focus on the big picture there. Think about that, what I call the locus of control within you, right? I run a program at the moment, Derek, called the 30-day dash, where what we say is you can influence the next 30 days. You can influence the next 30 hours. You can influence the next 30 minutes. In fact, you can influence the next 30 seconds by the thoughts that go through your head. So why don't you choose the most helpful question for you for the next 30 seconds, right, that can help you over the next 30 minutes? What's your question? Wow. And you focus people into what's the right question at the right time for the right person, which in this case might be yourself or a friend or a colleague that you're helping, right? That helps them to take control. And it might be then you're saying, I am going to go and dig my potato patch. Right? I am going to organize my next speaker. I am going to do that. And immediately you're taking control of something. And that's the importance of small wins.
I'm going to share with people what I do actually. So I say, I go out with an A4 piece of paper blank with a clipboard underneath it, and I'll sit there with a cup of coffee and I ask myself the open question, what can I do in the next 30 minutes to achieve whatever it is? And I just sit there until the answer comes up, or I put that by my bed at night and use the kind of Edison thing. But I know you've got something to add to that and something to question me on.
I have. Can you just repeat the phraseology of that question?
Well, I didn't phrase it very well, did I? And you're going to give me the better phrase. I know that. I can see from your body language, by the way.
Okay.
I didn't end it properly. What I was going to say, what can I do over the next, let's say, 5 minutes? Or what question can I ask myself over the next 5 minutes, which will give me the results I want today?
Right. I'm going to give you a big tip here. That if you'd learnt this 50 years ago, it would have changed your life even more, Derek. Right.
50 years ago, I wasn't born, Andy, as you know.
Right. So avoid the word can.
Okay. Right?
Because if you phrase that question, sometimes the brain will go in search of the easiest answer, which, if it's a challenging question, the brain will respond, I can't, because it's the opposite of can. If you phrase it, what could I do? Or even better, what could I possibly do? So what's the question that could possibly help me the most? The brain can't go, this couldn't possibly help you the most. So you phrase it, if you use the word could, possibly, or might, and you can use two of those, like what could I possibly do, what might I possibly, in a question that will open your mind up more. And the thing I use, let me show you, I've got it here next to me. My little black book I take out. On one side of it, I've got personal development. On the other side of it, I've got new product development and strategy development. And what I do is here, I just write a question at the top of the page. You probably can't see that well. And then I answer it 20 times. Okay. And all of those questions start with could, what could I possibly, how could I possibly, who could I possibly, all right. And that just gets my brain going. And I tend to do that 30 minutes at the start of the day and 90 minutes on a Saturday and a Sunday. And that's how I, you know, just discipline my thinking questions and phrase them right.
Now you use three words there. I wrote down could and possibly. What was the third
one? The other one is might.
Repeat the whole question for everybody, Andy.
Okay, right. So going from A to B, how could I possibly get from A to B? How might I possibly get from A to B? All right. Who might possibly help me? How? So the phraseology is, what could I possibly, how could I possibly, who could I possibly? It's almost like a rhythm, because what could I possibly, how could I possibly, who could I possibly? Okay. So, I mean, I even developed a pack of cards, Derek. And if I just show you these, how these. Jack, Queen, King. What could I possibly, how could I possibly, who could I possibly, right? They're just three questions on the back of 10 possibility areas to stimulate your thinking for any goal. So any goal that you've got, you can open your mind up by saying, what possible tasks, what possible resources, right? How could I possibly communicate my goal? How could I possibly gain buy-in? How could I possibly, what possible obstacles might there be? How could I possibly overcome those obstacles? What possible risks might there be? How could I possibly minimize or mitigate those? What possible assumptions? This is just a toolkit for any goal, and this is based on the research looking at the questions that people were commonly asking themselves when they were successful in getting from A to B. And then for any of those questions, of course, you can say, and what else? How else? Who else possibly could help me?
Fantastic. It's interesting, actually, that many, many high achievers write everything down in a very nice book. I do. Several people that have been on here do. But I see a lot of people never make notes when they go on a seminar, or I just don't know how they can remember it. So, nice to see your book. I have a bigger one, actually, an A4 book, not one of those little tiny ones. But there we are. And I was going to say, on a Saturday and Sunday, you haven't got much to do, really, have you? Because watching Leicester City can't really. Anyway, I won't go there on that. Andy, we're nearly coming to the end of the interview. Okay. I'm going to go to the chat box and see what we've got in there. And then I'm going to come back to you and ask you for one or two really simple tip-top tips for everybody. And you've given us some already. Mark says low-hanging fruit is very important. Of course it is. It links to the 80-20 rule. It links to making a list and deciding what's important. And it also links to momentum and energy, which we all want. I'm always surprised when people do something difficult first thing in the morning, because, you know, I want to get things moving and feel I've achieved one or two things very quickly. And I think that works. That's a long-hanging fruit. Thomas asks, what do you do in long-established industries or highly commoditized markets when everyone has picked the low-hanging fruit? The only thing I'd say there, Thomas, is that's an assumption. And I worked in a commoditized, long-established industry, and people miss the low-hanging fruit, actually. But let me ask Andy to...
A couple of things immediately go through my mind. So I've probably worked in about 300 to 320 different organizations around the world over the last 30 years. And the number one rule is, remember I said involve others, is the most lateral thinking part. It's people that think that they have picked the low-hanging fruit. Whereas actually, if you involve people at all levels and get them engaged in continuous improvement, there's lots more low-hanging fruit that have never been discovered. So sometimes when I go into organizations that, you know, typically I work between 2,000 and 10,000 is my sweet spot in organizations. We can equip them all with that shared model and create a series of 30, 60 or 90 day goals where everybody is looking to make a difference. Now, they might be little micro differences there, but if you've got 3, 8, 9,000 people making micro differences every 30, 60 or 90 days, you know what? It adds up to a lot of money in doing that. But it's also an engagement strategy. So I think that my first question would be there is, how many people have you engaged in picking fruit as a metaphor for getting that continuous improvement? And if you just say, well, it's this level or this department, or even worse, we've left it to the change department or the continuous improvement, I say, why on earth are you not engaging every single person in making a difference on a 30, 60 or 90 day cycle?
Yeah, I remember that. And I remember 3M, the person that invented the Post-it was just somebody who went to church, wasn't he, and worked for 3M and came in and said, we need these little sticky notes for the Bibles that we have, or something like that. And I always think it's extraordinary.
I did a load of work for 3M going back 12 years ago or so. They were a major client of mine. You know, the innovation's one thing, but what I'm talking about is making a difference every day, not just the big glamour innovations like Post-it notes, you know, or some. Do you know that the first 3M product was sandpaper?
No, I didn't.
It was, the 3M stands, I think it's the Minnesota Manufacturing and Mining.
Yes, that's right.
Stands for. Yep. So yep. They were mining it sandpaper. So, but anyway, it's the principle of engagement as many people as you can in making a difference.
Okay. Andy, there's nothing else in the chat box. I'm going to unmute people just for a minute, and then we'll come back to your three tips. So if there's any questions for Andy, we're still recording, and when it... I will stop the recording later, and Andy's agreed to stay on for a little bit longer with us. You're unmuted. Stick your hand up if you'd like to ask a question. Will Kintish?
Andy, 15 years ago, you and I had a cup of coffee at a hotel in the Midlands. You may or may not remember it. And you wanted an apple. We'd have a cup of coffee. You wanted an apple. So you said to the lovely waitress, "You know, you could get me an apple." She said, "Oh, I'm sorry, sir, we don't have apples." And you used some of these techniques. If you could, perhaps... change the situation, how do you think you could get me an apple? It was a cleverer question than that, because you're cleverer than me. And guess what? 10 minutes later, the apple appeared.
Yeah. It's all to do with the quality of the questions, Will.
I do
remember that. And it's most people, remember, will go for the easiest answer, particularly if they're under pressure. The brain will go, "I don't know where to find apples. I don't know. I've got that. I've got other stuff on." And you just need to calm them down. So, what if there was a way to get me an apple? Who might you possibly involve? How could we possibly, remember it's the could and the possibly, how could we possibly find a way to get me an apple so I would be so appreciative of you?
It was exactly that. I remember it. I mean, 15 years ago, and I've never forgotten it. So thank you.
The other one, I use this in restaurants, where I used to use it when restaurants were open, is I'm not a dessert person. I like to eat sorbet. And even if it's not on the menu, I will ask for sorbet. And very often is, "Oh, I'm really sorry, we haven't got any sorbet." And I go, "Well, you know that big freezer that you've got in the kitchen? I bet if you looked in the corner there, there'll be a tub of sorbet, but you just haven't seen it for a while. Would you go and have a look for me, please?" And they do. 50% of the time, I come back with sorbet.
Yeah,
fantastic. Okay, another, any other question? No, Andy, let's go back to your tips, but let's just talk about questions for a minute, because the quality of the question determines the quality of the answer you get. But also, it's not easy to think of the right question, is it? You need to take a time out. You need to study it. I'm teaching people negotiations, and I'm telling them you've got to sit down with your book, work out the questions, work out the agenda, take that into order, and you can control the negotiation. But you talk about framing questions all the time. Give us just a little insight into that.
Okay. So one of my favorite quotes, I've mentioned Einstein's a hero of mine, and particularly about phrasing questions. And he once allegedly said that if I only had an hour to solve a problem, I would surely spend the first 55 minutes determining the proper question to ask. So therefore, here's a person that's acknowledged as being a genius saying he would be prepared to spend such a disproportionate amount of time in crafting, or in his words, determining the proper question, because then he'd be able to solve it in 5 minutes. So sometimes when I need to convince particularly chief executives to work with me, I might say something like this. I'd say, think of a meeting that you're going to have in the next 24, 48 hours. And they'll think of a meeting. And I'd say, if you're chairing that meeting, what are the three questions that you most want answered in there? And they will think, and they will give me three questions. And I'll say, have you prepared those questions or just thought of them? And more than 80% of the time, it's I've just thought of them, but I know they're the right questions. I say, well, if I could improve at least one of those questions so that your people could do better thinking in your meeting, would that be worth having? And they go, well, which question are you going to improve? And I say, that one there. And I'll pick the question where Einstein would have spent a bit more time properly determining a better question. And it might be something simple like we've covered already, like putting a possibly a might or a could in there. Or it might be a question that is poorly phrased that will focus their mind on something different. And I say, look, and normally I can improve 2 out of 3 questions. That's my rule. Sometimes it's only one. And I say, now, let me tell you about a time when I was working in a bank in the city, and I was brought in by the CEO to run the ExCo meeting for 2 hours. And I said to him, this is what I'm going to do. You're going to run it for the first 2 hours. Then we're going to take a coffee break. And I'm going to run it for the next 2 hours. And all I did in the first 2 hours was I wrote down every question that was said out loud. by the chief exec and the participants. It was about 10 people in the room there. Okay, and there was 26 questions, and I looked at them and I was thinking about Einstein in my head, and I was thinking, you know what? There's only six of those questions that I think Einstein would have been proud of. Perfect phraseology, right question, right time for this right group of people. The others range from awful to okay-ish. So I got rid of the awful ones. I took the okay-ish ones and the bit of bad ones, and I rewrote them. And I ran the next 2 hours of the meeting, same subjects, but my questions being better. And boy, did we get better output when I ran the meeting. Better quality of thinking, better ideas, sharper conclusions, right? And that was the output of the meeting. Now think of the ripple effect of that, of those people going out the door, having had that affecting hundreds, thousands of people because of decisions that have been made in that room. So having a purposeful and productive conversation largely depends on the quality of the questions, and not enough people give that time and attention to designing or determining the proper question.
Okay, well, here's your last test, Andy. I'm going to give you a question that I use when I'm coaching people.
Yeah.
And you're going to improve it for me, okay?
Okay.
So when I've connected, built rapport, established it, I might say, where would you like to be in 5 years' time?
Okay. Well, if you were asking this in 2015, every single person would have got that wrong, Derek.
Does that make it a bad question, Andy?
Okay. No, but what I would do is, why pick 5 years? I think it's a classic one that people talk about 5 year and 3 year, particularly when they're talking about planning. So I would ask a person, think of a time in the future where you want to have achieved something or improved your life in some way. What sort of time scale are you thinking about? Then they would give me their time scale. Then I would take them to that time in the future and say, okay, travel forward in time to that date, that exact date. And I would pin them to a calendar date, not just a year. Okay, so the date is, and then I might do a visioning exercise with them, one of the four goal refining techniques, and say, so the date is, right? And what are you seeing? What are you hearing? What are you feeling? What are you holding, right? What's been completed that is the evidence of your success on that date? And I would go sensory specific to help them create a vision that they've chosen the date for. So that's perhaps how I might improve it.
Okay, so that would, yeah, I like that. I like that because I make a decision in my own judgment about what they might think that. So that's my assumption. So maybe 3 years, 5 years, depending on their age, depending on what they've told me as well. Would you take them down the timeline and say, now imagine it's 5 years' time and you've achieved that goal?
Yeah.
Or would you leave
I would take that
NLP technique out?
So one of the key principles is about defining goals. Let's go back to principle two in the GoMad Results Framework. That is about clarity of an end date, and being so clear that another person could audit you. That's my definition. You know, 9 out of 10 cats can tell me what SMART stands for in goal defining, but actually only 1 in 10 can do it to a standard that I would be happy for. So, for example, you've written a book, Derek. I've written many books. You knew that at one point you had in your mind, I want to write a book, okay?
Yep.
And you would have had a goal about writing that book, okay? And you might have visualized it, but there will have been an end date, wouldn't there? But if I said to you, on that specific date, Derek, what is the measure of your success that I could audit you on? Depending on which date you picked, you might say, well, actually, I am holding a copy of a book as evidence. That's the evidence, Andy. Or you might say, I will have submitted the manuscript to the publishers as evidenced by an email receipt. That might be your evidence, okay? So that specific evidence has got to be able to audit you. And the technique that I use on a lot of training programs is we do the £10,000 cash prize. And we go around the room and everybody's having to go, I've written a book by a day. Right, written. Is that draft, manuscript, printed? I'm sorry, you don't get the £10,000. You're too vague. Right, until it really homes people down. It's an imaginary £10,000.
Mm.
Right, but you know what, in a group of 12 people, it typically takes somewhere between 8 and 10 goes to get it to that level. And that's the learning experience for people with absolute clarity.
And that's the specific, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I had a dream to write a book. I didn't actually have a goal. It was quite interesting. And I thought the measure would be when it was in WH Smith's at Heathrow, that would really be the measure. And I saw it there in at number 3. I moved it to number 1, as we always do for our pals, don't we? If you ever see my book at number 16, please put it to number 1 and just walk away. You don't need to buy it. And which has always been a bit of fun and a bit of a joke. But that was it. But I never thought that. But what I didn't know was, which will disappoint everybody, of course, to be in the charts at Heathrow, the publisher has to pay. Publisher has to pay WH Smith, which blew me away. But that's the facts of life, and that's the way it goes. Andy, that's been absolutely sensational. Thank you so much. I'm going to close the recording now. But would you stay on for a little while to answer any other are there any questions? Thanks, everybody, for joining me. Thanks to Andy Gilbert for a fantastic session. If you're watching this on YouTube, please like it. Please make some comments. If they're nice ones, that's great. If they're not, please don't. And I look forward to seeing you all very shortly. Thanks for that. This is Derek Arden signing off. Thanks very much indeed, Andy.